This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We are hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore.
And yes, Ben's got a bit of a cold from his kids.
Yeah, can't stop getting sick. The kids go to school and they come back and everyone's sick again. Then they get better and then they go back to school. Anyway. Bit of a long episode today. We talked about the usual kind of stuff we talk about in a normal episode, but we also did a bit of a deep dive on, well, two things in the end. We talked quite a bit about asset location, and then we also talked at the end quite a bit about the new ETF model portfolios that we've proposed.
And then we covered off a couple of podcasts that we've been listening to with some interesting tidbits for investors. Some good information there about the industry, about the evolution of the industry, about working with clients. So I think there's lots of good stuff in there, but we'll make this short because the episode is a little bit long.
All right, here you go. Welcome to episode 36 of the Rational Reminder Podcast. As promised, today we're going to roll out our new ETF model portfolios, and it's only two new ETFs compared to a couch potato type portfolio that you might be familiar with. So nothing too revolutionary, but a meaningful difference.
So what's the main reason why you wanted to come up with this?
Well, we talked about it last time. We want to continue talking about factors and the importance of small cap and value tilts and taking independent priced risks in portfolios, but we wanted to scale back talking about dimensional based on the feedback we've been getting.
Yeah, and so it gives some listeners who want to do this on their own some tools to go ahead and do it.
Yeah, so we're not just talking about this is what we do. It's actually, you can do this.
You can do it, yeah.
And in my opinion, and we'll talk more about this as we jump into it, but if anyone's willing to slice up a portfolio for tax efficiency purposes, like if someone's going to go buy US listed ETFs in their RRSP to pay less withholding tax, they should absolutely be looking at adding small cap and value.
For sure.
If someone values simplicity and they're not buying US listed ETFs for tax efficiency, then maybe they shouldn't worry as much about the small cap and value. But anyway, we'll jump more into that a bit later. We have a few things to go over before we get there. One of the big ones that I wanted to start with was some new thoughts on asset location, which we talked about in one of our earliest episodes. Through reading and research and modeling and all that kind of stuff, we have come to the understanding that when someone takes their portfolio and puts all of their bonds in their RRSP, that's kind of the generally accepted asset location philosophy. And it does look pretty good. If you model a portfolio that's done that, all the bonds in the RRSP, compared to a regular balanced portfolio with the same asset mix across all accounts, putting all the bonds in the RRSP, it'll give you a better result, which is interesting.
But it's time period specific, right? You're talking about a falling interest rate environment?
No, it's not even that. It's even cooler than that.
Because?
It's because the pre-tax asset allocation, which is what people usually focus on, doesn't matter. The only thing that matters to your returns is your after-tax asset allocation. So if you go and put all of your bonds in your RRSP, the after-tax value of your RRSP, depending on what your tax rate is less than whatever's in your account.
For sure, depending on your tax bracket.
Depending on unless your tax bracket is 0%, it's going to be less, some amount less, 53.53% or less than what's actually in the account.
Yep.
Now, because of that, and because your after-tax asset allocation is the only thing that matters to your returns, if you put all your bonds in your RRSP, you end up with a more aggressive portfolio.
Because you have to grind down that allocation to fixed income by your marginal tax rate.
You have to, by your expected future marginal tax rate.
Right. So if you're saying a 50-50 portfolio overall.
Well, I did an example so we could talk about it. If you took a 60-40 portfolio worth $1 million, so about a $1 million portfolio with a 60-40 pre-tax asset allocation. So if we say there's a $400,000 RRSP and a $600,000 taxable account, we put all the bonds in the RRSP. That looks like a 60-40 portfolio pre-tax. But if we assume the highest marginal tax rate in the future, then the after-tax asset allocation of that portfolio is closer to 75% equities. Now, if we go and put a portfolio with the same asset mix across all the accounts, so the same 60-40 portfolio in the RRSP and in the taxable account, then our pre and after-tax asset allocations are the same. So it's a true 60-40 portfolio pre and after-tax if you have the same mix in all accounts, because you're burning down in the RRSP each asset class proportionally based on the expected future tax rate. So if we go and compare these two portfolios now, we're really comparing a 60-40 portfolio to a 75-25 portfolio. So which one's going to do better on average?
75-25, you would expect it to do better.
Because it's a more aggressive portfolio. So it's like, okay, that's interesting. Then what happens if we start thinking about asset allocation or asset location and allocation using after-tax asset allocation as the starting point? So instead of focusing on pre-tax asset allocation and trying to optimize the locations.
I can hear all the listeners collectively scratching their heads and wondering what is going on here.
I don't know what else to say.
I know, but we've been scratching our heads on this one as well for the past week or so, especially you.
Well, it's fascinating. But anyway, so if we optimize, if we control for after-tax asset allocation, that means that we would not be putting all of the bonds in the RRSP. And I guess if we needed a 60-40 portfolio, yeah, well, we couldn't put all the bonds in the RSP in our $1 million, 600,000 taxable, 400,000 RSP example, because we wouldn't end up with a 60-40 after-tax asset allocation. So we have this little optimizer tool that we built a while ago to model this, to model asset location. And in that tool, we can choose, do you control for pre-tax or after-tax asset allocation? And so when we control for pre-tax, we get the result we've been talking about, where the optimizer puts all of the bonds in the RSP. But if you instead control for the after-tax asset allocation, the optimizer will put mostly international stocks as much as possible in the RSP.
Because?
Well, they've got the highest expected return in the assumptions that we use in the model. And this kind of jives with...
And withholding tax as well? Is that what's also going on too?
Well, the withholding tax would be higher. So that would be a reason not to have the international stocks in the RSP. But anyway, that finding of control, if you control for the after-tax asset allocation that international stocks end up in the RSP, that jives with... A research paper that was in the Journal of Finance in 2004, which has this really interesting proof, like it's a mathematical proof showing that the only thing that matters for the optimal asset location is the yield. So the variable growth rate on an asset does not matter, which I still haven't fully wrapped my head around, but
people- So yield, you're talking about cash flow.
Taxable cash distributions on price. So their conclusion in the paper, or one of their conclusions in the paper, was that the highest yielding asset should go in your tax-free accounts. And it's actually interesting in the paper too, they don't differentiate much between tax-free and tax-deferred. They introduce the idea of the tax-deferred account. We only care about the after-tax amount.
And then that's the RRSP. Yeah, tax-free is a TFSA.
That's right. So if we take the RRSP and we're only worried about the after-tax amount, then all of a sudden the after-tax amount in the RRSP is really like a TFSA. So now I've got the RRSP and TFSA are both after-tax or both tax-free accounts if we're only thinking about the after-tax balance of the RSP. So anyway, this 2004 research paper suggests the highest yielding asset should go in the tax-free account, whether that's RSP or TFSA. And the reason that's interesting is because when that paper was written in 2004, the highest yielding asset was bonds. But now in 2019, with yields where they are, international stocks are yielding well above bonds.
So what's your bottom line key takeaway after noodling on this for over a week in the normal retail world?
Well, I think one of the major takeaways is that asset location is way more complicated than people think it is. And people following the common logic of putting all of your bonds in the RSP or as much bonds as possible in the RSP, you're truly ending up with a more aggressive portfolio than you think that you have. Now, I've seen arguments online that maybe that's a good idea. Maybe this is a good way to...
To fool yourself.
Arbitrage your own behavior, I guess.
Behavior arbitrage. That's interesting.
Because then you can have a more aggressive portfolio without worrying about it. But is that the prudent thing to do?
But is even the pre-tax, like really you have bonds in your portfolio as a dampener of volatility. So you still have the pre-tax amount of bonds in your overall portfolio, which will cause a portfolio overall to be less volatile.
Pre-tax.
Pre-tax, for sure. But no one thinks about it on an after-tax basis. As they look at their statements month in, month out.
Which is a problem, because the only thing that matters to your outcome is your after-tax asset allocation.
Oh, I get that. I'm just saying from a behavior, get someone who's, whatever, 10, 20, 30 years away from retirement, to get them there in a way they're going to behave well, they look at the real world value of their portfolio.
That is the strongest argument that I can find for trying to optimize for asset location. Although, I guess following that logic, you'd be doing it in a flawed way intentionally to trick yourself into having a more aggressive portfolio.
For sure. Absolutely.
Which means there could be a better way to have a more aggressive portfolio while having an actually after-tax optimal asset location strategy.
But go find me someone that might have a $500,000 RRSP that really thinks, it's only really $250,000 or $300,000. Nobody thinks that way.
Definitely not, which is exactly the problem.
Right.
And I haven't heard many people talk about this. Most people talk about, bonds in the RSP because you're going to pay less tax later, which is true. But when you start thinking about the pre-tax versus after-tax, the only reason that you're paying less tax later by putting bonds in the RSP is because you have less money.
Exactly.
The pre-tax portion didn't grow as much, which means your portion didn't grow as much and neither did the government's.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that, like I said, the main takeaway is that asset location, trying to optimize that is way more complicated than most people think. And to have a truly optimal asset location, I think that it ends up being meaningfully different than what people currently view as an optimal asset location strategy.
So you're then making a good argument to have the same asset mix across all your portfolios and forget about asset location?
Well,
that way it truly reflects what your risk preferences are.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the big things with the 2004 research paper that I mentioned is that that proof that shows that you're better off having the bonds in the tax-free accounts, like I said before, it relies on bond yields being higher than dividend yields. So as soon as that switches, the whole thing switches. But then it also relies on tax rates. So you've got to make sure that the tax rate on yield is higher than the tax rate on capital gains. Now, those are both things that could change.
Right.
Yields can change, tax rates can change. And so that's kind of when we formed our direction on having a balanced mix across all accounts many years ago when we made that decision, because we decided that if it happens that yields change and all of a sudden you've got now a suboptimal asset location strategy, like we've seen with bond yields coming down, making stock yields relatively high, now all of a sudden you're stuck. Like if you had all of your bonds in one account and the big capital gains and your international stocks in another account, now you've got a suboptimal asset location strategy. So what do? You change? Do you stay with the suboptimal strategy? And then what if tax rates change? All these different variables. That's why we decided to go balanced across all accounts, which is, I mean, this for me, this whole deep dive in asset location just reaffirmed that for me, because at the very least, you know what your asset mix is.
Yep.
Whereas if you're trying to optimize by putting everything in the RSP, for example, you don't really know what your asset mix is.
Or to know what it is, you have to do the math.
But you don't know what your future tax rate is. You don't know what your future income is. You don't know what future tax rates are going to be. So how do you truly build an optimal asset location strategy? Anyway, this is something that we continue to think a fair amount about, but our opinion as of now has not changed.
So what do you make of the performance so far this year?
I don't want to say it's not unexpected, because that's a tough thing to say, but you know, markets go down, they come back up. They could have kept going down, of course, which is why I say it's a hard thing to say.
But that's why you have to stay in your seat. We've said it so many times. 60-40 portfolio dropped down 5.something% last year, and it's now back above where it was January of 2018. So all of last year's losses and a little bit more have been made back so far this year.
Yep. And small cap and value have been on a tear so far this year.
Yeah, small cap value is up, I think, 17% year to date.
And that's IJR is just small cap market. I think IJS is small value. It's in our new model portfolios. Yeah. But yeah, like you said, staying in your seat is important.
Anything else to add to the model portfolios?
Well, we'll come back. I think we'll come back to that after we cover some more of, I know you had a couple of things you wanted to go over.
Yes, I was reading a fabulous book called Team of Teams, written by the U.S. General Stanley McChrystal. So he's a famed 4-star general, best known for being commander of the Special Operations Unit in Afghanistan. And it's a really interesting book about how management has changed over the years. So I thought what I was reading this morning, he talked about complex versus complicated. So the title of his book is Team of Teams, New Rules for Engagement for a Complex World. And maybe you cover this in your engineering background, I don't know. But I thought it was interesting how we contrasted things that are complicated versus things that are complex. So the example he gave was, a car engine is complicated. So all kinds of different moving parts that have been engineered over time. However, you kind of know what the output's going to be. It's going to propel your car forward. Complicated, he says, is more like a chess game with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of different outcomes. And you don't know how other parties in this game are going to react depending on new information.
Yeah, interesting. It's almost like intricate versus complex adaptive. Those words work better in my brain for the comparison.
Okay.
A car engine is intricate. A chess game or the stock market are complex adaptive systems.
But at the face level, chess is simple. People can understand the moves you can make. You just don't know how other participants are going to make them.
Right.
You start thinking about our world of finance and trying to predict markets and whatnot. You might see something as being obvious, but you don't know how the market is going to read into certain piece of information, be it the trade wars with China, be it the steel tariffs, be it whatever it might be. You don't know how all the participants are going to react to it.
Exactly. That's the complex adaptive. And it's this never-ending cycle of participant one trying to think about what participant two is going to think, who's trying to think about what participant one is going to think. And they're going back and forth in this cycle, but nobody can know what everybody else is thinking.
But it's happening at two levels, right? Because we're at the asset pricing level as investors. But down on the ground, you have companies doing the same thing with their competitors. So you got this dogfight at two levels. You got the companies, competing in the marketplace. You have asset prices or traders, brokers competing at the share price level. But yet you have retail investors who want to have control of their portfolios, trying to impart their beliefs on their portfolios, thinking about how stock prices will react to how companies will react. I mean, you think about it that way, it's kind of bonkers to think you can control this crazy elaborate, complicated, complex system.
Which is exactly what show up in the data. That's why people don't beat the market consistently.
Yeah. He gave one little stat in the book saying in November 2007 survey of 45,000, I'm quoting here, economic data series foresaw less than a 1 in 500 chance of an economic slowdown as severe as one that happened in 2008. In hindsight, it might appear pretty obvious, and we all know about the Big Short and whatnot, but it was not obvious to a lot of people at the time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I always come back to that data point in my head when we talk about stuff like this, of the stat on the performance of the S&P 500 over the last 10 years being basically statistically impossible based on the data that we had prior to that actual outcome happening. Stuff that just can't be predicted.
And another thing I listened to this weekend, I listened to the Michael Kitz's Financial Advisor Success podcast, which I know our listeners, that isn't necessarily their target kind of podcast, but it is for us. But he was interviewing Mitch Anthony, who's a well-known author in our world, keynote speaker and co-founder of what's called Life Centered Planners and another advisory firm in the US. Anyways, he was talking about the benefits that he saw working with an advisor, which I thought was kind of neat. So the points that he gave, one is the organization, kind of the corporate memory, consistency of experience you have with a firm. Number two is accountability. And he thought this was the biggest one. He says, why do so many people have, you know, exercise coaches and personal trainers and whatnot? Because they're not necessarily going to drive themselves as hard as they would otherwise. Another one is objectivity. Number four, proactivity. Number five is education. And number six is partnership. So he says these are all the reasons that he thinks why many people choose to work with an advisor. When you add that up, that's what should lead to a good investment experience.
Yeah, it's interesting. People often will say stuff to me, whether it's in person, during a conversation, or online. But people will often say stuff like, well, I can just go and get a plan from a fee-only planner for $2,000.
And just buy an index fund.
So what do you guys do? And it's hard to, I don't know if we've talked about this before in the podcast, but it's hard to objectify that, because a lot of the value in what we do is in the eyes of the clients that are receiving the service. And the value could be extremely different from one person to the next. But I think that list that you read captures a lot of it.
And the point of this is not to be salesy. The point is, if you are doing it on your own, which is totally fine, just make sure you've got all these things accounted for as you take care of your things.
Well, you won't. And I'm not saying, like, again,
you can take care of a lot of it. If you put certain rules in place, you can make yourself accountable. If you know you're going to rebalance every month or every quarter or whatever it might be, you can put the rules in place. Are you objective? I guess you can be as objective as you can. Proactive, you got to do the work. Education, again, you got to do the work. You have to do the research. But it's to be aware of what you're giving up if you don't have your own advisor.
And I guess, what does it take to truly be on top of all those things? And you definitely don't get continuity. One of the ones we interviewed, someone named Dr. Moira
Summers
for a future episode. And one of the things that she talked about was the continuity piece, where in a lot of cases she consults with high net worth families. She's a neuropsychologist, I believe. And one of the things that she sees is that there will be one person in a couple, I would wager that it's probably the male in most cases, is totally on top of this stuff. And maybe they do check all of those boxes that you just listed. But if something happens to them, then their spouse ends up in a tough situation. And that's something that I think it's pretty tough to replicate, I guess, unless everything's completely automated.
But how many times have people said to you, well, I don't quite see why I need you, yet their affairs aren't all perfectly buttoned down?
Yep. I mean, I've talked to people in many cases that'll say, yeah, I don't understand why I would pay for advice. And then you start digging into the situation and it's like, they haven't maxed their RSPs out in 10 years and
have a lot of cash, don't know how to deploy it.
Sitting on all this cash.
Should I buy a condo in Toronto? Yeah, I should get to my will someday.
Not sure about asset mix.
Don't have beneficiaries named.
Anyway, I want to reiterate, it's not a knock against do-it-yourself investing, but it is interesting to see the contrast between the people who say to us, well, why would we pay you? I had somebody actually recently say to me that they asked the question, well, how do you guys make any money? Because you give away all of the knowledge for free. It's an interesting question, but just because we're giving away the knowledge doesn't mean that everyone's going to go and take all of the knowledge that we have and perfectly implement it.
Strategy is easy. Execution is hard.
Yeah.
It's just like diet. I mean, we all know about diet forever. How come everyone isn't a chiseled specimen of a human? Like, it's just not easy.
Yeah.
He also had another good quote I thought was neat. If something is measurable, it will become a commodity.
Yeah, that is interesting. Really interesting.
So I know you saw this article as well on CNBC talking about the former bond king, Bill Gross.
Well, it's just kind of funny. It's just like it should be a comic.
So Bill Gross, famous bond manager at PIMCO. He was there for 40 plus years. He left after a pretty big scrap in 2014 and joined the Janus Henderson Group in 2014. They gave him a new fund, the Global Unconstrained Bond Fund, which sounds pretty cool. Quickly raised, what, $2 billion? I don't think it made any money in the time. And it's now dwindled down to $900 million or so. And he's just finally announced his retirement. The next month, it lost another $200 million in assets. And he's come out now on, is a Bloomberg article citing CNBC or perhaps vice versa, talking about how it's getting much harder to find mispricings in the marketplace. So here's a guy who touted himself for years of being the guy that can beat the market. People loaded him up. Like when he was at PIMCO, he managed, what, $270 billion fund? Made millions of dollars for himself and I guess investors. And now he's had his run. He says, it's pretty hard. You can't do this on your own. People can't beat the market. There's no more alpha left.
It's always that amazing question of, was he lucky or was he skilled? And I think one of the most challenging things about that question is that just because he is smart, which he is, and has a great background and all that kind of stuff, doesn't necessarily mean that he's a relatively skilled fund manager.
He even said that. Did you watch the interview?
I did not.
So he talked about how in their fund, they basically bought 10-year treasuries and let them roll down every year, roll down to 9 years, go back to 10, and leave, roll down again to 9 each year. So his interest rates fell for the decade. They made a fortune. He said it was basically easy. And here you go, have a star manager retire, money poured in when he went to Janus, and now people leaving in droves. So we've never been fans of banking on star managers, obviously. But it's a bit of a slap in the face, I would think, for people. So now they've rebranded the fund, given it a new name.
Yep, stuff like that is fascinating.
So you listened to that last podcast that we've been talking about, one on Invest Like the Best, the Patrick O'Shaughnessy interview with Michael Kitsis.
Yep. Yeah, that was a good one too. He kind of gave a history of the financial advice business and how it's evolved into what it is today.
It's crazy to think of all those decades where you had stockbrokers that were paid fixed commission rates of roughly 1% of the trade on the buy or the sell. So that's where the stock brokerage business came from.
Yeah. And then fixed commissions go away. So you got variable commissions. So firms start competing on how much commission they're charging. And then you get the discount brokerage. And then advisors who are wanting to sell advice type services, they start getting away from stocks because now that's a commodity. But then all of a sudden, mutual funds, this new thing. And so you need someone to pick your mutual funds for you. And now that's a commodity.
But they went to mutual funds because of the trailer.
Right.
Right? They follow the money.
Yeah.
I mean, Canada was, I came in the business when trailers first came out and the DSE fund was announced by Mackenzie Financial.
Wow.
It was what was his name? Jim something at Mackenzie created the deferred sales charts.
Wow.
So you sold a fund and you got a 4, 5, or 6% commission. So people started migrating towards mutual funds. So all of a sudden you became a manager selector person. And then as more and more technology came into play and more robo-advisors and all the price competition, Michael Kitsis makes the argument that people had to add more value in the vertical chain. So whoever's closest to the client keeps the margin and squeezes everything up above. So he says the whole migration towards indexing, his opinion is that it was based more on cost, not on the fact that indexing makes any sense.
I thought that was fascinating. Fascinating point.
Right. So, with us, it's a combination of the two, right? For sure. We absolutely believe in the philosophy, but he said that's not the norm. Most people went there because they wanted to keep their margin with the client, 75 or 100 basis points fee, and shrink all the costs up above.
We've even seen that from, I've talked to people who, not even going to index funds, just had an advisor that went from commission-based to fee-based, but the client's fee didn't change because the advisor ended up charging more for their fee-based service than they were receiving as a trailing commission when they were on the commission-based structure. You always follow the money. It's totally true.
I've been amazed. Some of the U.S. advisors that Michael Kitsis interviews in his podcast charge unbelievable fee levels. Like somewhere up 1.5, 1.75% on the first $500,000.
It's crazy to me. I think we live in this world where we're very much influenced by, I guess, the Couch Potato blog, really, which has been one of the main sources of information for people wanting to learn about index investing. And it's a very fee-focused blog in general. And I think that translates into the people that we end up talking to in a lot of cases.
I also thought it was neat how he broke down the U.S. market, basically saying when you look at where the money is and who's got the liquid money that can be invested, he says most of the investment advisor marketplace is competing for 7% of the population.
Wow.
Even less if you have a high minimum. So many firms have a minimum, say $1 million, or even in a smaller part of the population than 7%. But his trend, he says, if he looks out 15 years plus, he sees a huge trend especially in the US, where so many people have liquid assets, but they're in their 401k, so their group pension, group RSP type plans. So they have large assets, but not that can be managed by an advisor. So he sees an opportunity to charge people who have cash flow, but not liquid accessible assets. So to start charging them 1% to 2% of income.
Wow.
So let's say you have $1 million in your 401k and you make $100,000 a year, you go to place and pay a percentage of that taxable income each year for planning services, just because there's a whole swath of the marketplace that's in that situation in the US.
It's interesting. That's what the firm Financial Engines, they ended up merging with, was it Edelman?
Yep.
In the US. And so now that is an RIA firm, which is kind of similar to what we are, that also has an arm that can deal with the 401k.
Massive 401k. Like it's,
I don't know what the assets are. It's big though.
It's like $170 billion or something dollars.
Yeah.
I thought that's a neat model. You can see that coming forward. I mean, he's a big fan of AUM, which we are. We charge percentage of assets. So he says for all those, like those six things that we talked about earlier from Mitch Anthony. Is that his name? Did I get that wrong? Yeah, Mitch Anthony. So all those things, it does take a certain amount of recurring revenue to deliver that kind of platform. But he sees a marketplace for people who don't have those assets to pay 1% to 2% of income.
Yeah, that's interesting. Definitely not something that we've looked at actually implementing at all.
I'm not even sure if that kind of marketplace is here, because a 401k in the US, I think, is much bigger, but I could be wrong, than a group RSP.
We have probably turned away people who are interested in working with us based on their assets, regardless of what their income is.
Right. Well, because we have other people coming to the door with assets, so it's kind of supply and demand, right?
But we charge on assets. We could charge on income.
We could.
We've probably turned, I don't know. Interesting. Okay. So we've kind of gone on a few things here, but we do want to talk a little bit about the ETF model portfolios. So we looked at a lot of different ETFs as candidates for inclusion in the models. And it's not easy to find ETFs that truly offer exposure to the factors. So here we go talking about factors again. I hear people rolling their eyes, but the factors that we want to target in portfolios are the market, which you can get with a regular market cap weighted index fund, but also size, which is smaller stocks, and also value, which is relatively cheap stocks, and also profitability. So when you control for size and relative price, so small cap value type stocks, you can then control for profitability to find the stocks with higher expected returns and exclude stocks with lower expected returns. The prime example of that exclusion being small cap growth stocks with low profitability.
Right.
Now the challenge is, if you as an ETF investor go out and say, okay, well, I want small cap exposure, I don't know what percent, 90% of the small cap products are small cap universe.
With no exclusions.
No exclusions. So you go and get all of the small cap stocks, but I mentioned the exclusion of small cap growth with low profitability. That segment of small cap stocks completely ruins the size premium.
Yep.
And that's been documented in many different areas. I think my favorite paper on that subject is from AQR. Just because the title is hilarious, but the paper was called Size Matters If You Control Your Junk. And they're referring to small cap growth stocks with low profitability as junk. And they're arguing that small cap, there is a good reason to overweight small cap in a portfolio, but if you have the junky small caps, then there's no point. So you've got to control for the, as they call it, junk.
So what did you decide to go for in terms of tools?
You have to go small cap value, a small cap value ETF. And unfortunately, the only geographic region that you can get that for is US. And as far as my research found, there are not small cap value funds for Canadian or international stocks. So you look at, like, in Canada, iShares has a Canadian small cap ETF, great, but it's like a third in small cap growth stocks. So there's no point in having in the portfolio. You're just increasing your cost, increasing your portfolio turnover, increasing complexity for no benefit because of the small cap growth. International, again, there's nothing. Vanguard has this beautiful product called VSS, which is Global XUS Small Cap. But again, it's just small cap. So it's got a good chunk in small cap growth. There's no point in including it. You're just going to get all the bad that comes with factor tilting, which is slightly higher turnover, more complexity, but you're going to get none of the good of the size premium. And then once we get into, okay, we want a small cap value ETF for US stocks, even that's not easy. So you start getting into, how is that small cap value index defined? Anyway, without going through all the details, we ended up picking IJS, which is the iShares S&P 600 value ETF. And we went with that one because the S&P does their indexes by committee. They do it by committee and they have selection criteria. So they have tests for financial robustness and stuff like that, where they're not going to include a small cap stock that's about to go under. And the interesting thing about that is that because they're screening a little bit to find stocks for inclusion, when you run the regression on IJS, it has long-term and statistically significant exposure to the profitability factor, which is fascinating. It's not a factor fund.
Yeah, it may not be their intention either. Like, it's unintended positive consequence.
It's definitely not their intention. They're not targeting the profitability factor. They'd probably be charging a higher fee if they were. But just by nature of the way that S&P is creating that small cap value index, you end up with profitability exposure. Now, is that going to stay there forever? Maybe not, because they're not targeting it. But as the index is structured now and going back, like,
it's fascinating. They might think it's adding more quality to the portfolio, where it's actually getting you a better risk exposure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it ends up being the same kind of thing. So I thought that was really interesting. And when you start looking at other small cap value indexes, like the Russell 2000 value, it's fascinating. Depending on how you're comparing them, Russell 2000 value it's got more securities.
Yep.
It's got a smaller cap, average capitalization. It's got a deeper value exposure. So you start thinking, okay, well, maybe we want a Russell 2000 value ETF. But the problem that you run into with the Russell indexes is, well, they don't have any exclusions. So you don't end up with that profitability tilt, and you probably end up with some junk, as AQR would call it. But the bigger problem with Russell indexes is that they're purely quantitative for inclusion. So that's just like, as long as it meets the capitalization requirements to be in the bottom 2000.
Of the top 3000.
Of the top 3000, then it's included in the index. So there are no exclusions. There's no committee. So you run into two issues there. You end up with junky stocks, but you also have the issue of front running. So because Russell's going to reconstitute their index twice a year, everyone's going to know what Russell's going to exclude and include in their index before they announce it.
And don't they break down their 2000 into value and growth based on market cap? So each bucket has the same total value. So in the value bucket, you end up with more shares than in the growth bucket.
Oh, I didn't look into that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure when I did this years ago, I'm pretty sure that's how they do it. So they're actually not leaving out that middle range, whereas other indices do. They say, okay, if you're either strong growth, strong value, or you're in the middle, other index providers dump out the middle and just go to the extremes.
Huh.
I'm pretty sure that's how they do it at Russell.
That is interesting. So anyway, IJS is in for small cap value exposure. And then we also wanted to find market value, market wide value. We ended up going with IUSV, which is again an iShares product. And that's an S&P 900. So between the two, the S&P 600 value and the S&P 900 value, your total market value. And then for weightings, we just did 1/3 each in US market, US small cap value, and US value. So you end up with a pretty meaningful tilt towards small cap and a pretty meaningful tilt toward value, which definitely increases your expected returns.
Is this on our website yet?
No, it's not up yet. But we've got a paper that's just about finished that'll go out talking about this. So that can be a reference. And then we'll put out model portfolios too. Yeah. So anyway, it ends up resembling the couch potato model portfolio from a couple of years ago when they had a couple more ETFs in there before they started using XAW. So you've got your VCN for Canada, XUU or ITOT, depending on what type of account you're in for US, and then the IUSV and IJS that we just mentioned, and then VIU and VEI. We ended up going with Vanguard for international, developed, and emerging markets. But the interesting thing, when you look at the historical data on our new model portfolio, going up to 10 years, it has trailed by about 30 basis points, which you'd expect because we know value, particularly in the US, has underperformed for 10 years. But then going out 20 years, you end up with 36 basis points of annualized excess performance just by adding those additional weights to the small cap and value US market. So this is amazing, right? We're not even going...
Is you using the ETFs or using the indices?
ETFs. Okay. This is live
ETF. Live, real, net of MER returns.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, I mean, meaningful, right? 36 basis points per year on average. And that's including this past decade, which has not been very kind to small cap or value stocks. And I guess the big thing is for people to trust that these things are going to persist. And I don't want to keep going on, but there's good reason to believe that they will persist. And this one little 10-year period that we're in right now is not a reason to stop including small cap and value in a portfolio.
So going forward, this will be the portfolio we talk about in terms of performance and comparison purposes.
Yep. I've got one more data point that I think is fascinating to talk about. The lowest one-year return is a bit lower for our small cap and value tilted portfolio, which is kind of what you'd expect. It's a little bit more volatile with the small cap and value tilts. But when you look at the lowest three-year return, the proposed model portfolio with the additional small cap and value is 3% higher than a market cap weighted ETF portfolio.
Wow.
And that's where you start thinking about drawdown and retirement and stuff and accumulation, but 3% higher returns over the lowest three-year period. I mean, that's meaningful.
Per year.
Annualized. That's right. But that's what you'd expect because you're adding in independent risk factors.
Yep.
Anyway, so the paper introducing these portfolios and way more data on why people should be thinking about small cap and value is going to be up on our website soon. But other than that, I think that's it for today. Anything else?
No, great info.